A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 28, 2005, entitled, A Shared Yearning and Journey, The Religious Quest. The texts for the sermon are Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 through 13, and John 3, verses 1 through 10. Copyright Grand Valley State University. Please note that the original recording spanned two sides of a cassette tape, so there is some missing material. I will bridge the gap.
Last Sunday, I dealt with the peril of religion, trying to own up to its shadow side. The fact that religion in a literalistic and absolutist mode is a dangerous agent in society, fueling violence and war. But I ended by saying that there's another side to it, thank God, and referred to that religious quest that is intrinsic to our human being. That hunger for God, that thirst for the experience of grace. And that is the subject of this morning's message, A Shared Journey and Yearning, the religious quest. I selected the passages that were read dramatically for you this morning, not because I intend to deal with the content of those passages so much, as rather to use them as illustrations of my contention that the religious quest is really a universal human phenomenon. That it has always been there, and that it always will be there, and that it is perhaps the most fundamental mark of our humanity, that hunger and search for God. The two illustrations, one from the Hebrew Scriptures and one from the New Testament, couldn't be more different. From the Hebrew Scriptures, the writer of Ecclesiastes, probably some sage, is a skeptic. He will not buy conventional religion. He will not buy the easy answers of so much religious talk. In fact, when I read those passages from Ecclesiastes, I can't believe that the man ever made the cut. The third chapter was read for you, but if you would go to the first chapter where he tells what he's about to do, he starts out by saying, "Vanity of vanities," says the teacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And I'm told through my research that perhaps the best translation of that beyond vanity, which is a bit ambiguous in our present usage, would be absurdity. Everything is absurd. And then he goes on to talk about the monotony of life, what has been, will be. And he raises the question, is there anything new under the sun? And obviously his answer is no. And then he says, I, the teacher, when king over Israel and Jerusalem, applied my mind to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to human beings to be busy with. There you have it. An unhappy business, this human being and all the things that we busy ourselves with. He, as I said, is a skeptic, bordering sometimes on cynicism and simply unwilling to take the conventional answers. One commentator I read did say that he probably made the cut because he is there as a tonic to biblical religion. He probably made the cut because he's so honest. There was such integrity in his quest. And frankly, as you read through, you have to admit, if you don't paper over the cracks, and if you don't whitewash everything, a lot of the things about which he speaks are very common human experiences. And yet he didn't doubt the existence of God. He just felt that God was impenetrable and inscrutable. And there was also a kind of healthy adjustment to life. He embraced the whole of life. And that's what that third chapter is all about. That familiar passage about for everything a season. I love the 11th verse particularly. God has made everything beautiful in its own time and has put an eternal yearning in our hearts, even as we live before the face of mystery. Now, if you go to the King James Version, you won't find it just that way. I'll have to admit that's the RAR version, but I think that's what he intended to say if he had said what he really meant. In this skeptic, however, seriously, was that yearning. He busied himself with trying to figure out what life was all about and where God was and what God would have us do. And he's never very successful in coming to some satisfying conclusion. But the quest was there. His questions were there. His wonderings were there. And he couldn't be more different than the New Testament witness, Nicodemus. I mentioned last week that the fourth gospel arose in a conflict situation. The rabbinic party, the Pharisaic party, had come to the ascendancy in the last quarter of the first century. And coming to power, they insisted on a choice. If you want to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, you're out of the synagogue. Even though those followers of Jesus were fully Jewish, had no intention ever of forsaking their Jewish tradition. But again, religion at its worst, this or that. So in this fourth gospel, which is of course arising out of the Jesus movement, we have the example of a rabbi who came to Jesus. Now we have not a skeptic on the outside who refuses the conventional wisdom, but we have a guardian of the inside, an establishment figure. To be sure, he came at night, but then politics is politics. But he came, and he wondered. And Jesus confused him, obviously, as the reading indicated. He couldn't understand what Jesus meant when he said, you must be born again / from above. Much contemporary evangelicalism has made born again into a certain kind of religious salvation experience, but that really is not the Greek word, which has both that sense of again and from above, or spiritually. And what Jesus was saying to Nicodemus was that in all of your depth of understanding of the traditional the tradition of Israel, let me suggest to you that you need to keep eyes alert and live with attention to that which is breaking, so that Nicodemus becomes once again one with all those settled traditional answers and yet wondering, even if at night. And maybe it's at night that we wonder the most, no matter how convinced we are of where we are. And so, in those two witnesses, just an illustration, again, of my conviction that there is within all of us If we only would acknowledge it and let it free, that yearning for the experience of the holy and the sacred, that taste of a grace that embraces us, that touch and encounter with the presence of a mystery that is the source of our being and the ground of our existence. So I was blessed again this week with a windfall, having set this theme weeks ago. Into my home came Newsweek magazine with its annual spiritual review, a special report, Spirituality 2005, in which it conducted a survey with beliefnet.com as to where all of the religious attitudes and movements are today, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, even what are called the pagan religions, the nature religions, responses from people across that whole spectrum of the religious world, responding to where they are today, to what is important and what practices are being carried out. And that article, that special report, begins with reference to the Trappist monk Thomas Keating, who in the 60s recognized how the young people were attracted to the Eastern religions. Harvey Cox at the time, who was always writing just on time with what was happening, has a book, Turning East. And there was that movement, perhaps some of you with gray hair can remember, when there was the attraction to Buddhism, particularly Hinduism and so forth. But then the article goes on to say that, it says, Keating has spread the word to a world of hungry people looking for a deeper relationship with God. But then in the next paragraph, it goes on to mention the other phenomenon of the 60s. April 8, 1966, Good Friday, Time Magazine. I think Newsweek was delighted to show up Time at this point. Quoting Time, whose cover was black with a red border with large words, "Is God dead?" And this Newsweek account of Spirituality 2005 goes back to reference that 1966 issue of Time magazine that raised that question and refers to the 60s as a time of radical theology when the death of God was proclaimed by a group of young and rambunctious and very bright theologians. I can remember that issue as if it were yesterday. I wish I had preserved it. I don't think I have it anywhere in my archives, although the family after my death may find it. I don't know. I'm not going to look for it. But I've always said I want to go before Nancy because I don't want to deal with my books. That issue, I still remember so vividly, sitting in a chair in the room that doubled as a study in the parsonage in Midland Park, New Jersey. I had been here 60 to 64. I left in the spring of 64. I was in Midland Park. Here, my old ship of state was starting to leak. I found there that there wasn't any caulk that did it any good. And now, having been there a couple of years, I'm presented with Time magazine that raises the question, is God dead? I still remember sitting with that on my lap. It's Good Friday. Easter is coming. And it was enough to strike fear and terror into a young preacher's heart. And it represented a movement at that time, as I said, of young theologians who were raising critical questions to the traditional Christian understanding of things, calling for a radical revision of the Christian faith and its theological understanding. And at the time, it struck terror into my heart. I lasted there one more year and I fled to Europe, where for 4 years I had to wrestle with whether or not, indeed, I would have a gospel to preach or not. So that intellectual crisis referred to in this week's Newsweek, I went through personally. And I well remember the fear and the trembling. Actually, the death of God theology in the mid-60s was a blip on the screen. I think it was an in-your-face, too radical, a demand for theological revisioning. And of course, the conservative and Orthodox churches, it just became an occasion to speak about the horror of these people. And the mainline churches raised the walls high, and it never impacted very much.
And as this article points out, what really happened is that that radical movement that never took hold was literally shot out of the water by an exuberant renewal and revival, the Charismatic Movement. When I returned here in 1971, the Charismatic Movement was in full swing.
It made great inroads into the Catholic Church. There were healing services in God's frozen people, the Episcopalians. And there were charismatic prayer groups in communities all over the place. When I got back here, there was a charismatic weekly prayer meeting in Grand Haven, which was started by a Catholic priest who was on the faculty of Grand Valley. And it took people from all congregations right across the city, and it was quite a wonderful ecumenical experience once a week. My brother in the Baptist church at the time spoke against it, because these people were speaking in tongues and they were raising their hands and they were breaking out in song. And if there's anything a preacher can't stand, it's a visitation of the Holy Spirit during worship. I mean, the liturgy is set and the sermon has been prepared, and please, just, you know, wait. But, so my brother on the next block preached against the charismatic movement in the Baptist church. Well, I thought it was a rather wonderful phenomenon, and I spoke about it as I am now, here publicly in worship. The next thing I knew, the word got back to the charismatic prayer group, and they began to pray for Christ's community. And one Sunday night, they all came over, and we had a great love fest. Never forget it. But that whole eruption of spiritual life across the spectrum of the nation in various forms probably was a reaction to the deadness of a theological system that had been intellectualized and was rather lifeless and no longer really touching the people. So the death of God phenomenon never came to much. And the exuberance of the 70s continues today with 24/7 television and all of the accoutrements of our present age. But as I was thinking about it, last night I went to my bookshelf and I pulled down the books that I purchased at the time. There was Thomas J.J. Altizer's, Atheism, The Gospel of Christian Atheism, published in 1966, $1.75. And there was William Hamilton and Altizer's Radical Theology and the Death of God, in huge letters, just like the Time magazine. In fact, the Time magazine probably took it from that particular volume, which was published also in 1966, $1.85. And as I paged through those volumes that I still have on my shelf, I smiled to myself because they no longer struck fear into my heart. As a matter of fact, they were onto something. And the questions that they raised were questions that really cried out to be dealt with. The issues that they called forth were legitimate issues that needed to be addressed in the church in its own theological endeavor. So it was rather interesting to go back and to look what they were dealing with, and then to see how totally they were annihilated by the breaking forth of this religious enthusiasm, indicating, I think, again, a confirmation of my conviction that there is in the human heart a hunger for God that is insatiable and will in one way or another break forth. But I have a couple of observations about it. One thing, as I go back and look at these radical theologians, they weren't nearly as radical or scary as they might have appeared at the time. They used death of God, I think, as in your face, but as a matter of fact, their questions were legitimate. And what they were really calling for was a theological revisioning. And then a second observation I would make is that the exuberance of the religious revival shot them out of the water, but it didn't answer the questions. The issues that they raised are issues that still needed to be dealt with. And it is also my conviction that all of the religious experience and all of the religious enthusiasm in the world cannot finally overcome the gnawing questions of the mind. You've heard me say here many times that the heart cannot long dwell where the mind cannot follow. And so, as much as people were blessed in that outburst, the questions remained unanswered. And I believe that it is altogether necessary for us to go back to the questions without losing the experience of the holy and the sacred. It seems to me that Karen Armstrong has put her finger on something that's very important. That's why Lori read that quote. That's why I submitted it to the liturgy. For Karen Armstrong, it's clear that God is not at the beck and call of the human intellect. We do not come to the experience of God through the mind. A purely intellectual approach to God will come up empty. And so, as she says, we need the sacred ritual, liturgy, the sacraments, prayers. We need those practices that have been with us since the ancient church, those forms and structures that have become deeply rooted in our hearts and our experience because they have been washed over us again and again in the setting of worship as we were seeking the presence of God. It's not through the mind. And beyond that, Neil Postman is right. We need a story. Every people needs a story. And we are the products of that story, that biblical story. And so, as Neil Postman says, we don't reject that story just because this comes out of an age in which the whole worldview was totally different than anything we could conceive of today. But as is true with the sacraments, we still hark back and find our hearts warmed as we experience them again. But rituals and liturgy and sacrament are not only still dear to us in their ancient form, but it beckons us to reimagine them and to find fresh expression of them and to find new ways of communicating that same thing in the community where we have this shared journey and yearning for the presence of God. And the story, it's an ancient story. It's out of an ancient book. An ancient book, when literalized and absolutized, creates war. But a beautiful storybook of a past to which we are connected. But a story that continues to be reimagined and revised and retold in ever fresh ways. For we are not stuck in history, but we move with history. And in the unfolding of the human story, there needs to be a continual revisiting of that source from which we have drawn our spiritual life in order that it may continue to be brought to fresh expression, that it might continue to encompass the whole of life as we experience it today. Ritual, sacrament, prayer, the old story, all of it so deeply written in our hearts, all of it so dearly loved, being brought into fresh expression in a new day by an intellectual probing as well as a spiritual seeking. I think that's the alternative to a radical theology that says God is dead, or to an exuberant celebration that never worries about the intellectual underpinnings addressing the questions of the mind of a rising generation. There is an alternative way to go, to love the old, to freshen it with the new, and together in community to continue to open our lives to the presence of that mystery that is the source of our being and the ground of our existence. It's a wonderful thing to be at a point when I don't have to worry about whether things work anymore, when I have a little distance, when I can have the status of an observer. And let me say that I observe the present with equanimity, because I believe that there is in the hearts of us all a hunger for experience, for that touch of grace. And I believe that we are the finite expression of the infinite spirit, and that at the heart of our story is incarnation, God becoming human. So if God has become human, is there any wonder that the human longs for God, for the presence of the mystery that embraces and undergirds and overshadows all together in community, a shared journey, a shared yearning, always in the deep confidence that there is a love that will not let us go.